Mr. Gormley, Reel 37. You just arrived on the Imphal plane and you said that you went straight into action. And this was a major battle in the Burma War, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, this was. Having said that, it was spread over quite a wide area, you know. And as we got off the plane, we didn't even have time to sort things out. As the planes emptied out, we more or less moved forward because the attack was coming in down the hillside. And they were probably on the perimeter of the, perimeter of the airfield, you know. And, they were like ants. You just look at the hillside, was crawling with them as they come down. And, and we had to go straight into action, and you heard them like surrounded by a ring of steel. Well, there wasn't anything done there at that time. At the time, we just got everything ready and in action, and we waited for them, and waited for them. And then they just gave the word bam, and that was it. And every gun that you could think of that was on that line, it all opened up together. Nobody fired before then, no. They must have been waiting for it. And every gun, every shell was fired relentlessly. Throwing them at them, right, left, and center, and still in the cupboard. Oh, God. Are they never going to stop? And all day, from the moment we left the plane, I knew they're just a way back, bringing more people of the division in. And they were dropping them off, and we're just going into it piecemeal. And but fortunately, we had all our guns out and ready more or less within seconds. And we managed to stop them and drove them back into the foothills, and then they regrouped and they come back again. Oh, must have been at least 10 times they come down that bloody hill, charging again, and we just met them. Everybody, whatever they had. I think if they had a catapult, they would fire that at them. I'm sure, it was absolutely fantastic. And eventually, we've got to settle down for the first day like that. That was the first day.
How much of a battle do you actually see when you're working a gun yourself?
Nothing. You don't see anything. You can't see anything. All you can see is the way this was and where we were. We could actually see the shells exploding that we fired. You understand what I mean? Because you only fired 2,000 yards, you know. And it was a pretty flat plane. So you could see the bloody... the barrage just falling down, you know. And the range, it wasn't one you said, there was about four other divs in there, you know. Those 19s, was it? Either 19s and the 17s. But they had been coming up, they had been retreating into Imphal. 17s had already been cut off. We didn't know that at the time, you know, found this out after. They had been already been cut off, and I think it was the 23rd went out and broke the ring that they had put round them. And they managed to get in and get into Imphal at the time. So that was actually, it's about four full divisions. And our division, and it was the first time it had ever been done, we were picked up completely by air. Everything was picked up by air, and what would have taken us about a month if we travelled by road, would have taken us a month to get there. And this was an emergency, and we dealt with I don't know who prepared the plans beforehand or whether they'd been prepared or anything like that. But it must have been like clockwork, because they've put all these hundreds of bloody Dakotas down. They were just loaded in piecemeal.
Were these American pilots flying them?
They were all different. There was a lot of American pilots on that front. There definitely was. And they were all like mixed, you know. There was Indian pilots as well, but you couldn't place the edge at the first two, which for what they did there, not only what they did on the Arakan previous to this, and what they actually did there to bring all that stuff in under fire all the time, and going back round and like clockwork, bringing them all back in, you know, and more up, and then bringing the ammunition in and everything like that. Absolutely fantastic.
You've indicated that there was the plain and then the hills from which the Japs...
More or less a plain. It comes right. But you're surrounded by hills. Mm. Oh, yes, the hills have come going up 10, 5, 6, 7, 8.
And was it an open plain or was it cultivated or what?
More paddy fields, the old paddy fields. But at the time they were pretty dry. Pretty cast iron. You couldn't get through it. You couldn't even dig in to get in. It was like bloody iron. But of course, that soon changed because, as I say, about that time, the monsoons were American. Once the monsoon started, you couldn't do anything like that.
Was this the crucial battle when they actually stopped the Japanese?
This was, we'd already stopped them on the other camp. We'd done the fortress. And by the way, while I'm on, I'll just tell you a little incident that happened on the other camp. Because we were the first British troops that Mountbatten visited when we came in. We were the first British troops he'd acted. Seen when he took over supreme command, and we were down there north of Mount Dore, and that's what he said, call them into attention. So I called them very good to attention. We were dug in like a, and it was nice going to do it all right. And he walked my own back and all his entourage, and of course, I had my medal ribbons up, you know. The 8th Army vets on it, the 8th Army ribbon on, and the Rudy gun from the front AI. And he was over the book, mate. Oh, he said, I see you've been around a bit. I said, you stood there. I said, yes, sir, quite a bit, sir. Well, where have you been? So I thought, well, now's my chance. I thought, now's my chance. I get the whole bloody lot in there. Well, I said, I went through East Africa, up and down the desert, East Africa. I went up into Syria, fought the British French. I said, now come back, and I went up the desert and back and up down the desert. And they couldn't believe it, you know. He actually couldn't believe it. He could tell that. Look, and he turned to the colonel, a big fella, ex-heavyweight champion of the British Army, a fella called Bill Baston. And he turned to him, he says, is this true what he's telling me? This big fella. I thought, bugger him. I said, he doesn't know, sir. I said, he's only been nurse. He joined us in bloody Iraq. He's never seen this. I said, he doesn't know, sir. I said, I know. I said, good God, he says, it's unbelievable. He says, are you out here now? I said, yes, sir. I said, I don't very like it. I said, I don't very like it. I said, there's men round here. I thought, boy, since I'm getting me punch in here. I said, there's men round here. I said, going over two and a half years service in, because the had all this jungle warfare and whatnot. I said, and here's me. I said, I've been out here 6 years. Most of them have been fighting all the blinking time. I said, and I would love to get a boat home. I said, I would love to get a boat home, sir. I thought, well, you know, you've got the chance, you've got that chance, you know. He's a big Bill Baston, big fella, like a big ex-heavyweight champ, as I said. And he said, well, how many is there in the regiment with you? I said, there's 8 of us, sir. 8, he said. Is that all? I said, yes, sir. There's only 8 left out of the whole of the regiment. And the only reason they were left was because they were forming a new battery. That's how they were. Otherwise, the people like me, they would have been looking to come out. And so, anyway, irrespective of that, like, he said, good God, you know, you can see me on this. He said, good God. He said, look, he said, there's one thing I will promise you. He said, it's unbelievable, he said. And you had no leave? I said, no, sir, no leave. didn't tell them about the time we spent in Iraq, because we were supposed to come straight up. I said, no, sir, no, Lisa, I've never had time for Lisa. Come straight and up. So he says, right, he says, when I get back, he said, I'm guarantee, he says, that you will be on the first ship that leaves India for England. I'll give you my word on that. That's exactly what he said. And look, can he turn any water where from here to less than halfway to that door? Then he turned and he come back. He had a pretty smile, a smile all over his pretty face. And he said, that's if you're still bloody alive, mind. I thought you're cheating. That's the exact words that he barely let me with a bloody grin all over his face. He said, that's if you're still alive, mind. Could see his bloody shoulders laughing as he went away, you know, because he'd already told us, because he knew what was going to happen. He said, we'll feed you by here, you know. So anyway, that's what happened there, like you see.
So you had to adjust pretty quickly from a very mountainous terrain like the Arakan and then over to a plain situation. But you yourself, as you've indicated, had this tremendous experience in of different terrains and areas.
Yes. You see, this terrain here now, well, that was for 10 years, well, even longer actually. But for the first 10 years I was here, God knows how many troops yet. I mean, we've shipped down to thousands, literally thousands of wounded people that we shipped them out. So God knows how many troops he had there. He must have had at least 100,000 men, something like that. No idea, but that's where I would put it. And as I say, and they would come swarming down these petty hills, and they wouldn't there, and they wouldn't go back, you know. And you had to really knock them back, you know. They must have been at the point of exhaustion by the time they'd got the wolf later. So in the end, they had to go back and win them, you know.
Was their method of attack just mass force?
Mass, yeah. They would just come down. They would just come down, irregardless of what casualties it took or anything. It was like the Germans were in the First World War, which we've read about, you know, when they were marching forward with the rifles, and our lads were just sitting there, loading and shooting, you know.
And with the bugles, could you hear them coming? Obviously you could see them, but could you hear them?
You could see them.
They tended to blow bugles and things.
Yeah, we were probably so far away for building calls, if you understand what I mean, like the infantry men and that, they're open the front, like, I mean, especially any light infantryman, everything they do is on a building call, you know, but we were, and luckily for us, although we were close enough to the front line, we weren't involved in any hand-to-hand fighting or anything like that, not like we'd been down in the Arakan. Where you were seen from three. You didn't know where they were. You actually didn't know where they were until you ambushed them and they ambushed you. Because as I say, we always went out on patrol in the Arakan. We hadn't had time to do that. We just stood there and fired.
Did you fire on a set target, a set distance, as a curtain of fire?
Oh, yeah.
Or
yeah.
Did you discriminate?
That's what we were doing there. When we got the chance, we stopped.
A curtain of fire that you put up, in effect.
And then everything settled, and then as soon as they started coming down again, well, then you weren't firing anything deliberately, if you understand what I mean. You just threw everything down, whatever. Ben guns, whatever. You just put the bloody curtain thing right round. And they never infiltrated, they never got through. Much as they liked them, they never ever did get through, and that was went on for over a month. Yeah, it was a month like that. No one stopped fighting, and they never stopped coming.
How did you get? At some point, you must have been just on the edge of exhaustion yourselves, as in gunners.
Oh yes, yeah. Well, you drop where you start. As soon as we did in the desert, when they were in the Alamein battle, you know.
I mean, we you fired until sleep, you just dropped.
We had to fire X number of rounds, and that curtain had to be completed. So he just went on and on till he couldn't go on any longer. They had ducked and he was only cutting up, you know. I mean, it was just sheer exhaustion that made you duck.
And the rest of the gun crew kept firing, presumably.
There was always somebody there. You just say, carry on, I'm going to have a kip, you know, and down we'd go. And probably an hour, if you know, it'd be broken sleep, but at the same time, you'd sleep. Or you'd sleep. Yeah.
It's amazing you could sleep in such a tremendous racket, tremendous noise.
You don't do it. We never had a plug, anything like that. Never had them in my life. I mean, as I say, we used to say, but of course I couldn't get them then. I used to save all my craving here for cork tips. I used to put a high pocket full out of here every time I went in that, put in my ears, you know.
What were the shells like in Burma, in the sense of were they efficient, were there a lot of misfires, or, at this stage of the war?
I've never, ever come across a misfire on a 25-pounder. There were battles there, because there were a series of battles, like switched from one front to another, there was a big battle, something like Nunchingam or some name like that, a queer old name like Nunchingam. Now that was a hell of a battle. They attacked that because that was the key to that position. That was like a big salient come down the middle. And the Japs were already on that at the top. They're already taken that. And God knows how many times the infantry went up there and went, you know, tried to take it. Sometimes they got up and they captured it for a while, but then the Japs were putting a fierce counter attack, and they were taken back again. And God knows how many men were lost on that time. I mean, I'm talking about both sides. I mean, although we had a lot of casualties, they also had a damn sight more than we had. And I remember that was one big we had, and there was a one further on than that, which was around the corner, but what they put and say around the corner a bit, but quite away from there, what they called a hump. And that was what it was like a hump like that. And the Japs were right on the bloody top of that. And we never ever did take that back till they actually had to call a retreat when everything else had gone.
They pulled out.
Were
all these actions all part of the Imphal plain area?
Part of the Imphal area. So you would get that and stem it there. And then you would get to the what? And you'd be firing at another different target altogether, you know, something completely different. You would maybe have to move about a mile or something like that and come into action that way and go up that way. And you just went round and round in more or less in circles. And the only thing we missed there was our old 4-5 houses. If we'd had them, if we still had them, we could have taken that hump, as they called it, the hump. Somebody, they had queer names there, you know, Bullaway Hill. That was where the Japs actually turned them pretty around. That's it. They call it Runaway Hill. Aye. It's funny, Benny names come back into your mind, like, and but this, as I say, if we'd had the 4-5 houses, which would go up like that and down like that, and on this hump, we would dug in just on the other side of the hump. And of course, the trajectory of the 25 pounders was too low for it. See, they'd go up like that, and there's no way they could get over the top, not like we could with a 4-5, I would say. You could drop one right on the top of a pinnacle or anything like that, you know. So, we missed that then, because there was no way our guns could get there. The only ones that could have got them, I don't know whether they ever did them, but was like the mountain artillery, because they could just like that, you know.
Moving the guns in that terrain, particularly when you reach the hillier parts, what were you using to pull the guns?
Chefs.
Still the lorries.
Still the chefs.
You could get them round.
Yes. You had chains and everything that you could pull on. I mean, we found that out there. I mean, as I say, this was one hell of a battle. You can't really describe it. You'd have to go into detail, you know.
Were there any near misses from your point of view?
Yes, we were. We were always getting casualties all the time. There were casualties coming in. I mean, if you're lucky, like me, I came through it, really. And your casualties were always mounting. They were well treated, they were well handled, they had hospitals and everything done in there.
After so many actions over the Middle East and the Far East, did you get the feeling that, well, you know, my odds are getting a shortening here? And
well, I did in that time. That was the one time. After I came home back, you know, I was thinking to myself, I thought, my bones are going to bloody moulder out there. I did, honestly, you know. I thought, bloody hell, I've gone through all that bloody lucky, and I've been being all, you know, it's true. And I thought, bah. I'd hate the thought of my bloody bones lying moulding out there. That was what. You get the thought, like, you didn't dwell in it, you know, anything like that. You couldn't afford to let it dwell on you, you know, otherwise you'd go on a bloody twist. But
what do you feel helped you to cope with all these pressures, one after the other, over all these years, with so little break? Is it personality or, you know, your own philosophy?
I never had. Probably. Do you know, I saw a thing many years ago. While I was in the army, actually, I was on leave or something like that. And I saw this thing on a wayside poster. And I'll never forget it. Take courage, the worst ever happens. And I carried that through, right through my army life. It didn't matter what was happening to us. Even in the cauldron, we were bloody down to two bloody men. And there was a bloody shell. I'm not kidding. It hit there and it bounced off.
Just beside you?
Right beside you, as close as that to my shoulder. And it bloody bounced off. And I always remember saying to myself, take courage, Titch. The worst never bloody happened.
You'd have had a lot of changes in the battery, of course, since those days.
Yes, as I say, out of the whole regiment. The whole regiment, there's only eight of us left. And that, as I say, the majority of them have been down in the Cairo, reforming a new battery.
How did the new replacements and officers, etc., compare with the originals?
Well, we had the original officers. I couldn't fault any original officer we had. I couldn't fault anyone, not really.
And this new bunch, what were they like?
I couldn't even fault any of them. I was only, I could put my finger on two people out of all the officers and I served on it. One was a fellow that had done this. He'd come out from England, we were in Armagh's account, actually, I'm going back to the exact first story, but anyway, it's part of the story. And he'd come out from England, young lieutenant, he used to play football for the Corinthians, which was a great pre-war football team, you know, amateur. And he had nothing, common sense, nothing.
And what was his name?
I can't remember his name. Something like Carstairs, some name like that. And I probably dropped it down somewhere because an arm sergeant on this one, he said, I would come back to Armagh, you know. And I'm an arm sergeant on this one, and this bugger comes up to me and he says, right, sergeant, pick those bits of paper up there. I just looked at Mike, you know. That's it. And I said to the other guy, Bonson, pick them bits of paper up, put them in a bloody bin. Oh no, he said, I want you to do it. I said, you're not getting me to bloody do it. I said, there's seven bloody colours here. And they're here to do that. They're here to do what I tell them. You've told me to do it. I said, I'm telling them to do it. I'd be the one of opposite, but I must admit, even though I admire them, I never let them get us down. And he says, I'm going to put you under arrest. I said, you can bloody well do what you like. Anyway, it was up in front of the major. And his face and that stuff, but he must have put the... He looked at me and he said, I've got to bloody admonish you. You should know better than to refuse to accept an officer's order. I said, I didn't refuse to accept his order, sir. I said, I passed his order on, which is my duty. It's not my duty to go around picking bits of bloody paper up. See, you were trying to demean me in front of my own bloody gun crew. And there's no way anybody would ever do it. I wouldn't have allowed the major to do that, never mind him. And it's right, he says, admonished, out. You, stop here. the important amount he wouldn't have been a bit of legend. That's a true story.
But by and large, you said that the new officers that you'd accumulated during the years were pretty good. Many of the men obviously would be conscripts by now. You know, they weren't the regulars.
Yes,
and how were they in action?
A lot of conscripts came in, and fortunately, as I said, although there was only eight of us in the regiment that had actually started a war with the regiment. There was like other people who come in, like previously in the desert. And they're all more or less gradually fitted in with what we wanted them to do, like, you know. So, Queen old very well, like, you know.
Before we go on with the rest of the campaign, you were now in the Forgotten Army,
Yes.
And was that the prevalent mood in the army, that they were forgotten?
Yes. We were forgotten. You were definitely pretty forgotten. I've got a monologue written all about that, but that's beside the point. It's we were the forgotten army out there. You didn't have the bloody gear, and it was only the likes of Mountbatten and them that had got all this stuff together, and this Slim was a good general, like.
Did you meet?
You know what Slim did, and I didn't find this out till after. He'd actually taken about 50,000 to 60,000 bloody non-combatants out of the area. To leave just the combatant troops in the area. He took everybody up, all the people, all the civilians, everything. He sent a lot out by road, and then when the road got blocked, he took the rest out by air, and he took them all back down to Calcutta out the way. And he took the whole lot out, and there was only actual fighting troops that was left in that area.
This is Imphal. On the Imphal plane. Did you ever meet Slim?
No. I met him when he was there, like with Mountbatten. When he came around with him, like, but I was talking to Mountbatten, I wasn't talking to anybody. I'm telling a lie, I did meet Slim. I just remember now, I did. He was in charge of all 10th Brigade at Gallabat, the very first battle we were in. And he got wounded where now? About Tessenai or Karoo. Either Tessenai or Karoo, when he got wounded, he had to go back. And I'd never seen him.
This was Abyssinia, was it?
This was in Eritrea.
Eritrea.
And I'd never seen him again until I came there.